it will actually stay. So I was going to go through the to-do list and turn it into a discussion about obnoxious opinions and whatever. But is it too late? If it's too late, I'll just turn. It's 12:30. The conference is supposed to end at some point. Okay. So here it is, completely disorganized. Tell me what you want to hear about. Or yeah.
So one thing. Sorry, I did one right. I did the seventh point or so. Execute the dreadful double procedure at 11. That's what I talked about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. So that was in. Where is it? Oh, right. So this was in the to-do list when I wrote the handout. Roland. To be fair, you did it in the epsilon equals to zero case, but we should still do it in higher epsilon case, and that will completely get rid of the algebra.
And
in fact, I want to make a philosophical point. I think for the long term, sorry, now I'm speculating about what this particular branch of mathematics might look like, a few years from now. For the long term, okay, maybe I'll start with something else. I've never understood quantum groups. It took me, for 20 or 30 years, I was staring at these formulas and they didn't make any sense to me. Let me be bold and say that the same is true for most of you, and for those of you who think it isn't true, it's because you're in denial, and maybe then there is one exception or two in the room, okay, to all of that. But basically nobody understands quantum groups. And what it meant to me, sorry, I said I would make obnoxious opinionated statements, so here I go. What it meant to me was that there was no, as a topologist, I never had a way of starting from, here is a problem in topology that I want to solve, and it leads me in some natural way into writing the commutation relations that people write in a quantum group. So from a topology perspective, quantum groups were always parachuted from the land of the giants above us, that sort of they parachute into our subject. We don't know where they come from, but they work. Okay, okay. Anyway, sorry. So that's point number one. Point number two, and then I'll combine them. So point number two is that eventually, so basically, this story is a story about perturbed Gaussians and. Well, it has, and it's a commutative story. I mean, the things you do with it are complicated, the zipping and etc. But it's a story about perturbed Gaussians, where the Gaussian part is the Alexander polynomial, and the perturbation part is God knows what. But a priori, it doesn't say Lie algebras anywhere. A priori, it doesn't say quantum groups anywhere. I mean. The moment you produce these tensors, the moment you produce these Gaussians, they work. It doesn't matter if they came from a quantum group or not. So there should be a way to axiomatize it. There should be a way to abstract it and completely get away from quantum groups. And then I would be happy, because quantum groups have been my enemies since I was a little kid. Okay? Now I'm making confessions, you see. So it's not only obnoxious, it's also... And so basically, one should be able to start from these and say these naturally correspond to various properties of the Alexander polynomial. And in fact, they do naturally correspond to various properties of the Alexander polynomial. So one should come to these rather naturally and then say, can we put a perturbation, a P, so it's not the same as Roland's P, this is a double strash P or blackboard P, but can you just put a perturbation on each one and in a way that the same equations, which are not theoretical, would still be solved? And so one day people will do that. I will do that. Sorry, I mean, if nobody will ever listen, I mean, but in principle, one day somebody will do that. Possibly only me or Roland. Okay, so you'll just start from these and put in perturbations and ask yourself, what do the perturbations have to satisfy in order to still solve all those double equations, etc. And these are really not quantum group equations. These are not theory equations. And either you will directly be able to enumerate the P's, the perturbations that solve this, or it will become a certain homological process. And I've seen such homological processes many times, so I'm kind of not afraid of it, but it's a work that has to be done. So maybe people familiar with deformation theory know how it leads to homological questions. So I can imagine that sort of figuring out what the P's are, what are the allowed P's are, would be a homological question, but it would be a natural one. It would not coming from a parachute with a parachute from outside. So I think now I've explained point number
7.
I don't remember which, but anyway,
7 on the left.
One of the points, okay, maybe none of the points here, but my long-term view of where this is going. So at the end, this perhaps in a different language, right? The language might change, but sort of this will be this. Can become fundamental, and all the quantum group nonsense be removed. Okay.
So I think also relevant here would be to ask what the break group representations are, and I would like to suggest that it's the Lorentz Kramer Bigelow representations that come out. They have to.
Yeah, but now you're getting into yet another place where I'm opinionated. So, okay, first of all, yes, Braid group representations came out of it. I think I've displayed them briefly on when I was obnoxious after, not Kulkarni, Konstantinos talk. Oh, here. So you get very easy to write Braid group representations, which may or may not be the Lorentz Kramer. But now my opinionated bit, braids are lovely for themselves, but not terribly useful for knot theory. A, if you have a knot with n crossings, you need n squared crossings in the braid in order to represent it. So whatever the argument, so basically, any invariant you get, which is computed from braids, if you can rewrite it directly in terms of knots or tangles, you win. Okay? Or alternatively, if you wanted to compute the Jones polynomial using braids, instead of e to the n, you get e to the n squared. You lose. Okay? So anything you can do, if ever you can do without braids, you're better. Okay? And you can argue that you don't care about computations, but then what's the point? Sorry, I mean, why define complicated invariants of knots if you never are able to compute them even for 817? What would you do with them? As topologists, I mean, so it becomes the theory of invariants rather than the theory of knots, because those invariants aren't going to tell you anything about knots if you can't even compute them. So that's one reason I don't like braids. And the other reason I don't like braids is because they actually, there aren't many properties of knots. Maybe now I'm just wrong, and Thomas will correct me, or somebody else will correct me. But there aren't many interesting properties of knots that can be stated in the language of braids. So, and again, if you want to understand what I mean, then look exactly at the first page of my handout where I said you can express genus in terms of tangles. You can express the ribbon property in terms of tangles. Maybe one or two other properties, but not too much, okay? But I mean, at least you can express something. But using braids, I don't know what you can express other than things which are obviously, sort of, you can express the braid width of a knot using braids, but that's sort of tautological. Okay,
you can express the fact that a knot is transverse, for example. How do you explain it? Express it without.
Okay, so.
Transverse to contact structure, I mean.
Okay, so then I stand corrected. Maybe there are a few properties that you can express via braids, but I think there are. I don't know many. Okay, I don't know. So somehow, if you have an invariant that has a good behavior on braids, it might tell you something about the transverse property with contact structures. I don't really know what it is, but it's not going to tell you much about, well, other things. Okay? So hence my bias against braids in knot theory. Braids in themselves are lovely. I mean, you know, you can ask lovely questions about braids, but the relationship with knot theory is actually not very strong. Shoot me. Say something awful. Let me fight with you so that we actually learn, so that I learn something and you learn something. Yeah.
Okay, and I even serve to your opinion that if it's not computable efficiently, it's not interesting. I'm paraphrasing. I'm simplifying your opinion.
Yeah.
Is that it might not be efficiently computable now, but in a century with different mathematics or different points of view or different relations, different computers, it might be. And I mean, isn't it why we do pure mathematics, that sometimes they might invent bank codes from prime numbers, stuff like this, things we've never thought of?
Yeah, yes, you have a case. Sometimes mathematics that looks completely untractable now becomes tractable later. But it's not that non-computable things have no value. It's just that you have to multiply their value by some factor which is inversely proportional to the length of time that it takes to compute them. So you know, there is a hierarchy in mathematics. There is some hierarchy in mathematics which starts from things which you can compute in linear time. That's the absolute best. Okay, if you can say something new about something that can be computed in linear time, that's amazing. It's rare that you can do that, but okay, then there is polynomial time, then there is exponential time, then there is altogether recursive, which could be, you know, Ackermann or, you know, worse than Ackermann, Busy Beaver style computations, if you know what these are. Then there are things that are simply not computable, like set theory, large cardinals, etc. And at the risk of making a lot of enemy, I will say that the value is decreasing as you go along this. It doesn't go to zero, but it decreases as you progress in this ladder. Or said differently, or said in other words, the the redeeming the other redeeming features of a theorem must be much, much, much bigger in order to justify. So for example, Gödel's theorem is not about anything computable. I mean, strictly speaking, it's about computation, but in practice, it's the computations that cannot be done. So I mean, Gödel's theorem is sort of non-computable, but it's but the philosophical value is so tremendous that you're ready to forgive it. Okay, but if you're going to say something about stuff that's computable in Ackermann time, it better be damn interesting. Okay? Yes?
So coming back to the to-do list, why did you put the while group? What do you mean by the action of the while group?
So for example, when you will look at SL3, suppose we were to do the SL3 example. In the SL3 example, there will be two central variables, because the Cartan is two-dimensional. So you will get the invariants will become polynomials in two variables. And in general, for SLN, you'll get polynomials in n minus one variables. But you don't but you somehow still expect it to be dual to representation theory. Representation theory, is somehow described by highest weights that lie in some chamber or something. And then if you get a function of this highest weight, you can extend it to the entire plane or n-dimensional space by the action of the value. So in a similar way, you would expect that the polynomials that you will get will be invariant under the action of the while group. I don't know how to see it in our language.
So for SL2, you get some...
For SL2, it's the fact that you get that the polynomial should be invariant under t goes to t inverse. It's actually not obvious from our language.
Right, that's not true in the virtual case, is it?
And it's not true in the virtual case, correct. So okay. As you know, I have, for this particular one, I actually do know how to do it. For t goes to t inverse, I actually do know how to do it. I still don't know how it will generalize beyond. Or maybe it won't. I mean, maybe the match between, I mean, maybe you'll actually get more. And you'll get more because you will not necessarily start from a group, but from something else. But, you know, that's definitely something to do.
So, I don't know. I mean, many things here, I mean, you know, figure out the action of the...
Oh, you know what? I'll just say in one word... Yeah, it's time to quit.
5 minutes.
I'll just say in one word the loop. Why is this the loop expansion? Right. What is the loop expansion, and why is this the loop expansion? Okay. And again, I'll be using the finite type language, which is related to the Lie algebra language, which I think eventually will be phased out. But that's the language I currently have. Okay. So the Concievich integral is an invariant of knots with values in chord diagrams modulo 4t or whatever it was, and that space can be shown to be isomorphic, so you can look at it a little bit and see that it sort of models the universal enveloping algebra of Lie algebra, and then with the PBW theorem, it can be shown to be isomorphic to kind of the symmetric algebra of Lie algebra, which in the same combinatorial manner is isomorphic to the space of unit trivalent graphs. Okay? So graphs that, sorry, trivalent graphs that are also allowed to have a number of legs, univalent eggs, legs, but the legs are not enumerated, so they're symmetric. Okay? And modulo, just one single relation, if I remember right, which is the IHX relation. Okay? And I'm proudly the author of this relation. So, anyway, such a diagram has, you can count how many loops it has. Basically, H1 of this diagram is how many loops it has. So this diagram has 1, 2, 3 loops. This is a 3-loop diagram. So if you mod out by things with k plus 1 loops, you're left with things with up to k loops. So the 1-loop invariant will be about diagrams that have only one loop, so they have to look like wheels with hair, and that turns out to be the Alexander polynomial. The 2-loop invariant will be the next one, and will be the next thing in the Rozanski hierarchy, and so on. And this was known to Rozanski, this was known even before Rozanski, this was known to, well, people who were in Aarhus in 1995. Sorry, I'm now speaking to Gregor, who was there. Okay? Anyway, how is this related to our stuff? So you see, there is a similar story. So there is a virtual Z, which goes from virtual knots into, well, what replaces core diagrams, it turns out, is arrow diagrams. So diagrams like core diagrams, the only difference is that there is an orientation on every edge. And then what replaces this is unitrivalent diagrams that have, again, oriented edges. Well, I will not write all the orientations, but all of them should be oriented. Modulo an oriented version of the IHX theorem. An oriented version of the IHX relation, sorry. Now, here I should have said that not all vertices are allowed. There are only two types of vertices that are allowed. The one in, two out vertex, and the two in, one out vertex. And you can interpret this vertex as corresponding to the bracket in roughly the same way as in which all of these vertices corresponds to the structure constants. These correspond to the brackets, and these corresponds to the co-bracket of a Lie bi-algebra. And then these relations turn out to be exactly the bi-algebra relations. And then what Roland and I do, or this modding out by epsilon to the k plus 1 is equal to 0, is really, so epsilon, if you go back, was a factor which we have multiplied delta with. So we are really modding out by, do not have, whenever you have more than k vertices like that, you're equal to 0. So really the universal version of our procedure is to say whenever you have k plus 1 of the co-bracket vertices, so whenever you have k plus 1 of these, you set everything to be equal to 0. Okay? And in fact, that's how it started. So up until 3 years ago, I was studying the case where k is equal to 0, namely, I looked at the quotient of this story in which you simply completely disallow the two in, one out vertices. And that's the story of W knots, which has to do with four-dimensional topology. And I wrote a number of papers with Zhuzhana Damcho, and you know, maybe some of you have seen some of these. and probably ignored. But then I decided, well, what's the next step? Now I want to go beyond Alexander. So beyond Alexander, you mod out by having two. So instead of allowing no such vertices, you say let's allow one, okay? And that's where it started, and then we switched to an algebraic point of view, namely to the algebras. But it started, as I said, okay? And now you want to know what is the relations between the two. So there is a map from knots to virtual knots, namely every knot is in particular a virtual knot. It induces a map from here to here. So, I don't know, call this map A and call this map alpha. There is a map alpha from here to here, and it's actually very, very simple-minded. All it does is it takes every undirected edge here and replaces it by the sum of the two ways of directing it. And if you get vertices that are not allowed, you kill it. Okay? So there is a very, very simple-minded map going from here to here. And this map has the property that it descends to the quotient. Namely, if something has k plus 1 loops, and you map it to here, or maybe, yeah, then necessarily it will have at least k plus 1 co-vertices. And this is actually sort of obvious. I mean, just see what you can write. So, let's do the k equals 0 case. So in the case of k equals 0, what diagrams can you write without using the co-vertex, using only two in-one-out vertices? So you can only write trees, which are definitely zero loop, and wheels, which look like this. These are the only things that you can write. Hence I wrote papers on trees and wheels and invariants of W knots and stuff. Okay. But that's and you can see that it generalizes. You can check that it generalizes. So so basically the algebraic story of modding out by epsilon to the k corresponds to the loop filtration in the old language of finite lap invariants. I don't know if I've answered.
So where does the rotational fit?
Rotational fit. Oh, sorry. I'm always here being short. I mean, really, I mean rotational virtual knots. And I'm also a bit rough. So this part is, this side is totally solid and well understood. This side is sort of, the understanding is a bit fragmented. So we know a picture like this exists, but we don't, but not all the details are set in. And there are a little bit of, there are more complications. I've given the simplified versions. There are complications. So, this isomorphism theorem is true with no small print. This isomorphism theorem has some small print in it. Nobody knows much, or very few people know much about it, basically because virtual knots are kind of they're studied by a different group of people, and the people who study most of what was studied in this conference don't appreciate virtual knots. Sorry, I said I'm I am opinionated. This is opinion about how people work. I mean, there isn't just mathematics, there is also social dynamics. Maybe I should quit.